Hey there, we're live tonight with School Psych Podcast, and our topic is Functional Behavior Assessment Part 2. Very happy to have our two amazing guests back to kind of continue that discussion that happened a couple months ago. So I'm hoping that maybe people thought to refresh their memories a little bit and maybe listen back on what we covered before. But regardless, I think it's going to be a great episode. But first off, my name is Rachel, and I am a school psychologist working in Maryland. Rebecca?
Hi, I'm Rebecca, and I'm a school psychologist working in the state of Connecticut. I want to remind you guys about how to participate. Right next to our video, if you're watching us on YouTube Live, there is a live chat box. Feel free to put your comments and questions and thoughts in there. I'll also be looking on School Psych Podcast page on Facebook. Comment anywhere on the page or in messages on the Facebook page, School Psych, your school psychologist, or on Twitter using the hashtag PsychedPodcast. We can't wait to hear from you guys. Here's Anna.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm a school psychologist working in New York State. I am very, very excited to introduce our guests to you guys. We have Dr. Kristen Johnson. She's the owner of the Institute for Evidence-Based Reform, and her website is www.mybehaviorassistant.com. Check it out. We also have Ryan Farmer coming to us. He's an assistant professor of school psychology in the Applied Psychology Program at Western Kentucky University. His background is in school and pediatric psychology, and his research interests are in functional assessment and function-based interventions. Thank you guys for joining us again. I just listened to episode one again. For those of you out there who haven't heard it yet, check it out. These guys were awesome, and thank you for coming back, and take it away.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate coming back. We had a blast the first time, and Ryan and I have had many giggles over what we talked about the first time, and only geeks like us can have many giggles over many things that we talked about. I'm understanding that we took a poll on some of the frequent behaviors that we're seeing on or that we asked about. Is that correct?
That's right. It was a little tricky for me to word it, but I asked people to give me ideas of why they got called into a classroom to do a functional behavior assessment. So I asked for behaviors and the suggested functions of them, you know, sometimes that teachers or other people on the team might suggest.
Okay.
Yeah. So our top interfering behavior was physical aggression. That got the most votes. Physical aggression, striking child or adult with hand, foot, or head, and the hypothesized function is work avoidance. The second one was engages in tantrums to get what he wants. And the third one was talking back to the teacher to get peer attention. Sounds like maybe a class clown kind of scenario.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we first want to do, and I think Ryan and I will talk about them, is the functions of behavior, and we're going to review them once again. And Ryan's actually sharing his screen on the four functions of behavior.
So just really briefly, the four functions of behavior have a wonderful little acronym, I guess. It's SEAT. It's sensory, escape, attention, and intangible. Sensory is... you engage in the behavior because it provides you with some automatic experience or something about it that you like, something physiological or whatnot. There's escape. That one's a little more common, a little more easy to understand. I'm gonna hit the teacher because I want to get out of hitting of working on math or reading or whatnot. Then attention. That one's you're acting out or you're engaging in some behavior in order to get someone's attention. That one's pretty clear. I think it's safe to say we're all engaging in attention-maintained behavior right now. And then tangible is you're engaging in some behavior to get access to some toy, some item, or some activity. Anytime we drive through Starbucks to get our coffee, that is a tangible behavior. So.
That was an awesome example. Oh my goodness. Okay. So the idea of what the poll did with the physical aggression, thinking of work avoidance or escape, and we would call that escape to what? talking back to get peer attention or teacher attention. We think about those things as, okay, now if we understand the function of behavior, we want to, and we know we've defined the behavior well, we want to talk about describing the function-based treatments to that. How I do it and how Ryan does it is that we think about a competing pathway. We think about the antecedents or what triggers that behavior. So we can take physical aggression, striking a child or an adult. What's the trigger or the antecedent to before striking out? Was it a worksheet? Was it a task command? Was it a sitting next to somebody? What was the antecedent? Then we operationally define the behavior. But then when we operationally define the target behavior, which is the physical aggression, we also talk about what's the alternative and then what's the goal. So we think about what's the goal. We obviously want the child to complete the work, all work, get more work, have more work. I mean, because it's never ending. I mean, you know, think about it. We have really smart kids that have figured out a way to get out of work completion because our other kids, what's the alternative? If you complete this worksheet, you just get another worksheet. We've got really smart kids that go, wow, if I just smack somebody, then I don't actually have to get the next worksheet. So I'm joking. Please take my humor in jest. But we don't always want to go to the goal. We're not always going to work towards the goal behavior first. We're going to look at how do we look at the antecedent intervention. And when we think about antecedent interventions, we think about how can we modify it? How can we reduce it? How can we eliminate it? I love antecedents. Antecedents is like my game. Love going into the classroom and thinking about what do I need to do so that I can prevent the physical aggression, or I can prevent the talking back, or I can prevent the tantruming. So let me give you some examples of a child who's non-compliant, because that's often, I don't want to do what the teacher told me, or get in line, not going to. Start your work, not going to. Often very high non-compliance. Well, I see FBAs and I see when given a task demand, the child displays work refusal. Well, what's a task demand? What does that look like? Is it that the teacher asked it, will you please start your work for me very kindly in a question format? Or was it start working on problem number one? Was it that the teacher was very far away, so there's no proximity to the child? Was it that the teacher didn't get eye contact, so the child was not attending? So there's all these things around giving a directive or giving an instruction that we can now look at in such a deep format that we can actually prevent some of this stuff before it ever occurs. Not saying that noncompliance just magically goes away, but we can actually, when we're thinking about noncompliance, work refusal, a lot of the functionally relevant interventions, we can reduce that between 40 and 60% in some of the studies just by manipulating the antecedent before we even have to do the struggle of the kid not completing or being non-compliant or tantruming. Well, when I talk to teachers about, well, if we can reduce it by 40 to 60% before we ever get to how do we handle a kid who's escape maintained or how do we handle a kid who's attention maintained, they are super gung-ho over manipulating that environment, because that's also, I think, for a lot of teachers, very natural because they modify instruction in their classroom instead of them thinking of the terrible word bribery. We're just bribing kids. That's not at all what I think we do. However, I understand what their kind of philosophy around that. So when we think about antecedents, we need to think about all those kind of areas that I think are just so dynamic. Not completing work or work refusal. Let's look at the actual work, what's being presented. Are all the problems so far ahead that the child is at the frustrational level? Well, can we use incremental rehearsal, or can we use what we call probability sequencing? High probability, an easier problem, a more difficult problem. A more difficult problem. Instead of just saying, well, instead of 20 problems, we're only going to give them 10. We have now reduced this child actually learning the 20 problems. We've reduced their capacity to learn all of those problems. And we don't necessarily want to do that. There's lots of antecedent functionally based interventions that we can do when we think about what's the trigger and how can we manipulate that to get the biggest bang for our buck. I can go on and on and on about antecedent interventions, and I'm absolutely hogging right now. I'm sorry, Ryan, you can absolutely jump in, but it's so important to think about the antecedents and how do we really understand that when we do our FBA, we spend so much time in assessment, but do we really spend enough time understanding that all the dynamics, all the variables around that antecedent, whether it is a task demand, or whether it is a written assignment, or whether it is a math problem, or whether it is a social situation. I can think of lots of children who display lots of inappropriate behaviors in a social situation. When presented with a social situation, I happen to be one of them.
I really before, and thinking back, there were, you know, I'm going to share a brief case I worked on where this kid would literally engage in self-injurious behavior every time they was asked to write a sentence. And we found out, okay, what if we vary up that instruction a little bit? Let's just have him write a single word. Okay, he's still engaged in that behavior. He would still hit himself. Okay, what if we show him how to spell the word at the same time he's being asked to write it? So now we take out the question of, does he know how to write the word? So he goes about trying to write the word, and he still engages in that behavior. And I said, okay, at this point, we've broken the task down to very, very, very basic levels. What can we change about this instruction, about this task? Again, not even worrying about function right now, but purely antecedent interventions. What can we change to make this go away, to reduce this behavior? And so I said, well, let him type it. Let's just let him type it instead of write it with a pencil. And last I checked, he has not engaged in self-injurious behavior again in over 2 years. Something as simple as going from a pencil to using the touch screen on an iPad. And it's incredible the amount of change you can see just by making such small and simple manipulations up front. And think about it, if you're going to ask a teacher ultimately to do a huge contingency management program, when in the beginning she could have just let him use an iPad to write it out instead of write it with a pencil, mm-hmm. which one of those is going to require a lot more effort on her part or his part?
I had a very similar case probably 15 or 17 years ago where all we did was a grip, a pencil grip.
Yeah.
And a lift.
Wow.
No more exhibiting the complete and utter meltdown, throwing the desk, the entire classroom having to leave. Now, it took me a hot minute to figure out grips and lifts, but that was actually a lot of fun for me because I feel like I'm being an investigator and I'm figuring out what's going to be the best possible solution for this child to engage in their instruction so that they can learn. And so I think sometimes when you're getting into this for the first time, it can seem overwhelming because there's, lots of possibilities, but trying them out, I don't see any harm in it unless it is like self-injurious behavior or physical aggression. I'm not advocating for it under those conditions. But a child who's tantruming or a child who's off task, a lot of these behaviors we can have fun with trying to figure out what it is that we can reduce, eliminate, or modify to get the, you know, those behaviors to at least reduce to where they're manageable, where we can do the consequent interventions and they're not as much for, say, the, you know, the teacher to handle. Now, one of the things that Ryan brought up was the alternative behavior. So you went right into the alternative behavior. Some of these things that we're talking about aren't necessarily the goal behavior, but they're their alternative behavior. And so when we think about when we're writing our behavior plan, I see so many behavior plans going directly to the goal behavior. And let's think about how we just learn how to, say, put on shoes with shoelaces and tie them. We're assuming that a child can, the goal behavior is that they put them on, they tie them up, and they walk out the door with independence. Do we ever start there with children? No. We teach them how to slip on their shoe, right? How to pull their laces. And depending on which philosophy you are, of bunny ears or not bunny ears, you see where I'm talking about. It's, we have this problem behavior and we're immediately going to the goal behavior as though there's no steps in between. And we really need to think about the steps in between by still allowing them to get what the function is. So if they are attention maintained, then we allow them to have access to that attention as they're getting to the goal behavior, or we allow them to escape to something, because we always, as Ryan always says, which is always perfect, we don't escape just to escape. We escape to something. We escape to maybe the school psychologist because they're so wonderful and so sweet and so nice and so caring. Or they like to stay out in the hallway because they get to see everybody passing in the hallway and then they can, you know, act up or cut up or talk to people. Or they like to go to the office because they are interested in what everybody's, what's going on. And the secretary, you know, talks to them about what's, you know, what's happened. Or they can go to Dreamland and think about, you know, their vacation place or the, you know, weekend or whatever it is. We escape to something always. So we want to think about, and one of the people that are on my page as well as your page, Eric, asked the very question about seeing that goal behavior and not really kind of backtracking to those alternative behaviors first before we get to the goal behavior. And I think that's the second step that we're often missing, because by the time that we're called in, as all of us know on this podcast, by the time we're called in, they want an answer and they wanted it a week ago because they've tried everything. Teachers try everything. The last thing that they want to do is to be able to say, I don't know what else to do, because they're problem solvers just like we are. So everybody's kind of at a level of frustration that's it's difficult at times.
So I wanted to bring up something. Kristen's been talking about alternative behaviors for a few minutes, and there's a bit of a terminology thing here. Like we talk about alternative behaviors. We can also talk about incompatible behaviors or other behaviors. All of these things, all of these things are types of replacement behaviors, different types. So yep. In general, replacement behavior is just a really broad term for any behavior that replaces the problem behavior.
Yep.
And alternative, other, or incompatible are just components they're under.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's perfect.
Okay. Can you explain that a little bit more? I know, like, I'm familiar with replacement behavior, and I go through that in you know, when I'm writing an eval.
I'll tell you what, let's take incompatible and other behavior first. Incompatible is a behavior that you cannot do at the same time as the problem behavior. Whenever you get a teacher to tell their students when they're lining up, put your hands in your pocket or hold your hands so that they can't hit their peers, compatible behavior. You know, I love the example of if you have a kid who's picking their nose, give them something else to do with their hands. That's an incompatible behavior. They cannot do those two things at the same time.
High school teacher who had a student that fell asleep in class, would have the student stand up because it's incompatible. My dad would say that that's not incompatible. I can't sleep when I'm standing. However, it's the op. You can't do the incompatible behavior. Thumb sucking. So anything hands down at side or extended is an incompatible behavior because you can't have your hands completely out and suck your thumb at the same time. Mm-hmm. So they're incompatible with the target behavior.
A really common one in more clinical practice probably is chewing gum for smoking. It's incompatible, those two behaviors, or mostly incompatible. I suppose if you're talented, you can probably pull it off. it's just another example. It's you can't do them at the same time, or at least it's not easy to do them at the same time. When you get into other behaviors, literally we're talking about any other behavior that a child could do instead of the one they're doing. It's not necessarily incompatible, but it's any other behavior. Alternative behavior is another term. It's another level up in complexity because it's actually another behavior that results in the same function as the problem behavior. So if the function of hitting was to get out of math homework, then you might use the alternative behavior of asking for a break during math homework. They're not incompatible. They could hit you while asking for a break, but they serve the same function. And since one is easier, asking for a break, and doesn't result in them getting in trouble, they're more likely to begin to use that behavior over time. So that's kind of the difference when we talk about, you know, the different types of replacement behaviors.
Absolutely. Okay, go ahead, Ryan. No, because I was actually going to put it off to you on, we've talked about the antecedents, we talked about some of those replacement behaviors, alternative behaviors, incompatible behaviors, you know, so now we can talk about consequence-based interventions. Any questions so far or anything that you want us to go over or go more in depth before we actually go to consequence-based, or is there any?
We had a viewer, Eric, who just loved the antecedent strategies, Kristen. So that's our comment so far.
Oh, good. Okay. So consequence-based interventions is really, let's give an example, and then we'll backtrack into more terminology. So many of you have heard of the daily behavior report card or check-in and check-out. Check-in and check-out is an attention-based intervention. However, I have seen it given on a time or two that it is given to a child who is escape maintained. Well, have you ever had a child that doesn't want to go see the mentor because they could care less whether they go to see the mentor because they really don't want to see the mentor because they are not attention maintained? Check-in and check-out is not going to work for those escape maintained children. But check-in and check-out is an intervention that you can add to the daily behavior report card if they need more attention because the level of attention that they're getting with just the daily behavior report card is not quite enough. And so you can add check-in and check-out as an attention maintained intervention. Those are most common.
Yeah. So kind of to emphasize the importance of understanding function before selecting a consequence-based intervention, I really want to point out this example. Let's go back to our cliche kid from this conversation, the kid who is engaging in aggression in order to get out of math work in the classroom. All right, this kid is engaging in this behavior to escape from something that he doesn't like, okay? That makes perfect sense to all of us, I feel like. It seems pretty clear. So what is an easy strategy to manage the situation? You could send him to the guidance counselor's office, right? That's one thing that I see a lot in the schools I've worked in and consulted with. Except here's the thing. If you're sending this child out to the guidance counselor's office and he's not taking that math homework with him, what is he doing in relation to that math homework? He's escaping. He's avoiding that task that he didn't like to begin with, which means that aggression worked. So the phrase I love to say is dysfunctional behavior is still functional behavior. Yep. Even though it's not something we want to see, even though it's a maladaptive behavior, it's still serving some function. And we have to be knowledgeable about that before we change the environment or the consequence, because we don't want to inadvertently reinforce it more. And I feel like that situation happens in a lot of schools and a lot of different situations. So a lot of people can kind of see, oh, this is something that's pretty normal that does not work. So in that situation, what might you do instead? You could use some of those alternative behaviors we talked about a minute ago, asking for a break, anything along those lines. Or you might go to a consequence-based strategy wherein, and this may not be, this is not in any way ideal, or I'm not even suggesting that this happen, but for every time they hit you, they get another math worksheet added to their stack. I'm not suggesting that, but what is probably ideal is some version of extinction there. So not allowing them to escape from the situation. Oh, you hit me, do number five. Oh, you hit me again, you still need to work on number five. So making it so that the function of that behavior, they're no longer accessing that escape. They're no longer getting to escape from the task. They're having to keep doing it.
I think that where I run into trouble, at least, is with the kids that, you know, they're escape driven, but, you know, the school isn't staffed maybe to deal with the level of aggression that these kids are able to produce. And, you know, we have to take them out to maintain the safety. And I'm just like, oh.
Yeah, my recommendation there would be to go with some of these antecedent interventions that Kristen was just talking about, because then you don't, ideally, right, you're getting rid of it 40 to 60%, I believe that was the figure, you're getting rid of 40 to 60% of the problem behavior. And so now, even if you do have to deal with some of these consequences, you're dealing with substantially less of them.
Yes. And that is, it is such a marked difference. Now, let's actually talk about your escape is extinction, because that we've all been in the situation where escape extinction is a route that we may have to go, but we don't have the resources, or we haven't adequately, you know, I don't ever say to a teacher, just ignore that and continue to ignore that. I don't ever do that unless I haven't, like, for at least a day or two, I have enough staff that can handle whatever's going to go on, and everybody is trained, because once it's over, it's pretty much over. If I can get through the day with continuing to extinguish that behavior, I don't have to deal with it again. But sometimes that absolutely has to happen for those kids that are now just up in the ante. We were just talking back to get to escape. Now we actually, because we've tried to extinguish it, we've actually gotten to the point where we've escalated it to physical aggression. And I don't ever do that unless we have a very well-trained and everybody's on board and everybody agrees to it and everybody knows the plan. But it is well-documented, well-trained. We know when it's going to happen. But that's not necessarily, as Ryan said, that's not my first go-to move. My first go-to move is all the other things, but I still have to write to what happens when they're physically aggressive. But hopefully with the antecedent interventions, the incompatible or the alternative replacement behaviors, we have reduced it enough that those are going to be less competing. Because if they can escape to something else, and it's much easier in what we call a response effort, I can get it much quicker than physically aggressing. If all I have to do is say break versus I have to come up to you and I have to slap you or get you within proximity, and you're really good at not getting in proximity, the response effort is much less for saying break please, or holding a green card for a break, or some kind of visual prompt, or some kind of auditory prompt, something that says I can have a break. So that, go ahead, Ryan.
I was talking about coffee earlier. You know, what if we have a bad habit of going through Starbucks, right? That's my issue, going to that drive-thru on the way to work. Well, what if instead I have a Keurig in my kitchen. It's much easier to get decent coffee without going through that drive-through, without spending the money. My response effort is lower. So I'm going to get Keurig coffee instead of going through the Starbucks line. That is an antecedent intervention that's actually causing me to avoid the behavior entirely. And that's just one very simple example, but it's powerful how these things can have ripple effects and actually reduce a wide variety of behaviors.
And then how would you deal with the kid that, you know, is break?
That's a great question. Here's the funny thing is that's almost guaranteed to happen.
Yep.
But I would tell you to reinforce it every single time in the beginning.
Yep.
Then once you haven't seen any problem behavior in a while, then we talk about fading that out, about reducing it. Instead of reinforcing it every time, it might be every 2 minutes you'll reinforce it once, or every 3 minutes, or every 5 minutes, or maybe even every other time, or every third time, every fourth time. We'll find some way to fade it out where the child is still being successful, the child's still getting breaks, but it's not quite as often. It can be a slow and challenging process, but it's effective.
Yes, and I think the tension and the stress level comes down a great deal, particularly when you're talking about physical aggression. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much the other behaviors, but the other behaviors are either functionally different or their topography is much different than physical aggression. So many of my teachers that have to deal with physical aggression on a daily basis and multiple times a day, if they are so happy, if they can get a child to say break multiple times and experience little to none physical aggression, then we definitely are. And of course, we're keeping data on how often they're asking for breaks, how many seconds, and how many actual breaks did they have, so that when we're going to fade out, we fade out based on the data.
Yep, absolutely.
You want to talk about attention-based?
Yes. Attention-based is great. there are lots of different strategies for that, and it varies depending upon whose attention they want. That's a really important question up front. It's really easy sometimes to say, hey, this behavior appears to be attention maintained. Excellent. Whose attention? Are they trying to get their classmates' attention? Are they trying to get a teacher's attention, a guidance counselor's attention, a school psychologist's attention, and so on and so forth? You've got to answer that question in order to really think about the variables around that functional intervention you're going to be creating. So for example, if it's teacher-based, then you can structure that in such a way where let's talk about non-contingent reinforcement for a moment. This is a type of antecedent intervention you could do up front where a teacher would maybe turn to a child every so often, again, based on the data, and give them a little bit of attention. Now, ideally, what this is doing is it's decreasing their motivation for that attention later on, so that they're less likely to engage in those high effort behaviors, the acting out, the talking, the hitting, if they even went that far. And so by doing that, we're able to minimize, again, that magic 40 to 60% from antecedent interventions. And then we can just work on expanding how long we can go between attention, between the teacher giving them attention. Kristen, it seems like you have something you're thinking about.
Sorry. My facial cues, I can't play poker except online. Anyway, one of the things that I found, you know, quite interesting, and I'm putting a little bit of a wrench in this, is that some of the studies that I've done, and when I talk about my studies are in school settings, are with kids in the classroom. My studies are not in, you know, I don't wear white lab coats or any of that, but it's really interesting because we really did a lot of stuff on attention to escape. And so for teacher attention. So a child may say, hey, 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 hey. Teacher comes over, walks through the problem. The problem becomes easier because the teacher walks through the problem. Therefore, the child is escaping because they want the task to be easier. And it's not necessarily attention. You following me? So I'm getting your attention so you can reduce my task effort which is really escape maintained. So we see some attention to escape. So when you're doing your FBA, you really want to give some qualitative indicators of what that attention is like. Mm-hmm. So, and it's really easy to actually test that out. You can ask the teacher, when Johnny asks for your attention, I just want you to say things that are not instructionally relevant. How are you doing? What's your day been like? What you having for lunch?
Sing a little song. It really
exactly.
Doesn't
it really doesn't matter.
Right.
In the other portion, help the child with the problem. Mm-hmm. You will see a dramatic difference in whether they are just attention maintained, where they just like the teacher to be there, or they like the teacher to be there to help them with their work. And that actually will reverse you right back into the antecedent and help you figure out where you need to focus your attention on in those antecedents so that you're not just you're thinking, oh, well, I'm just going to give attention. Well, no, the quality of the attention is really so important in that aspect. So that was my kind of thinking, Ryan, mm-hmm. was that.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. I think that really, that does matter a lot. It's definitely a needs to be part of the assessment process.
It absolutely does. My best friend and I were having a discussion about children who are, and we were having this a little bit of discussion before the podcast about being socially avoidant. Okay, so you can have two people who walk into a social situation and they basically walk right back outside of the party because they don't, or recess. Or cafeteria because they don't want the social interaction. You have one person who really could care less about social interaction, right? You have those that don't really care to have friends, aren't really that socially motivated. Then you have those that are socially motivated. They want to have social interactions, but they're anxious. But if you just did a straight up FA, Ryan, wouldn't they both look like escape maintained? Mm-hmm. But if you don't start looking at the topography of their behaviors and some of the dynamics of if you changed up the social situation, made the number smaller, had friends around, did something different, the person who it doesn't really care, it's not really going to matter who's in the room or how small it is or whatever it is because they don't. It's really not a reinforcer. The person that actually is more socially avoidant because of anxiety will engage when it's a smaller number or will engage when they know people. And so just to say that their escape maintained is not always necessarily the best picture.
Right.
So
it's part of the picture. It's an important part of the picture.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely not where you should stop questioning.
So that sounds to me like you're talking about really understanding the individual child's strengths and weaknesses. Is there anxiety? Is there an academic weakness, you know, that needs to be pre-taught? And so once you know the function of the behavior, then you go back and look at strengths and weaknesses and see if there's something there that can inform your antecedent intervention.
Yeah. Kind of speaking towards the example Kristen gave a moment ago of the child who's doing attention to escape. In that situation, you've learned, oh, he's trying to get me to help him with the problem, so the difficulty of the problem is lower. Seems to make perfect sense. So one antecedent intervention that you might try is pre-teaching. Mm-hmm. So instead of having to go over periodically, you do it all at once. You kind of walk him through one problem and you say, okay, give the rest a shot. And then you can step back and be a little more hands-off. And what you've effectively done is you've hopefully made all of the problems easier up front and accomplished your goals.
Yes. Another one is you can take some pieces of – many people may have heard of cover, copy, and compare. And so what you do is that you actually have some examples of them walking through the problem. So the teacher doesn't have to stand right there and pre-teach all the time. You can actually have an example of work. And that reduces their effort and reduces their willing, or, you know, their behavior to escape the task. And so even printed cards that have the steps, you know, these are the steps to solve this math problem, or these are the steps to write a sentence. Remember all these things. You can have that so that it reduces the task effort for them, but doesn't display that necessarily the problem behavior. So those are all that, all the things that we do, whether it's CBM or whether it's the academic interventions that we know, so that we can find their instructional level, or the academic interventions that we know, or knowing something about the child, is all going to play into that FBA and really creating some of the best stuff that we do. It's, to me, it's the most exciting things that we do, because ultimately it changes the interaction, the child's life, how they, every possible event that's going on in the school.
There seem to be two questions that are outlying, and I think we want to try and get to those before we wrap up, which is pretty soon. The first one was, we started down this attention rabbit hole, and there's an entirely separate attention rabbit hole, and that is peer attention. How do we handle a situation when it's not the adults who we can talk to and reason with and say, hey, I need you to not do this anymore, but it's the classmates who they're making laugh or who they're talking with? And there have been some pretty interesting research studies and projects done where they've effectively done a class teaching exercise where they teach students when and how to respond to their classmates. And having classroom management systems and things in place can actually help to manage some of that. Obviously, it's really hard, and I think Kristen would agree with me here, to give a blanket answer on that one, because it totally depends on the topography of the behaviors, getting attention from the peers, and the peers themselves. And are they the kids you can sit down and go, hey, you know, it's really not great that little Sally's, you know, interrupting class. Could you please try and make sure your attention is on the teacher? There are some kids you can do that with, and it'll be really effective. There are some kids you cannot do that with, or for whom that will be ineffective completely. Kristen, would you add anything there?
No, I absolutely agree with the assessment piece is the most important, but I will give some examples, because once you do know your child and you do understand what kind of peer attention that they need, there are some really excellent interventions for possibilities. Okay, so there is the good behavior game, which they're using with Classroom Dojo. It can be set up in very different ways. There's positive peer reporting. Some people call it tootling.
Tootling, yes.
So that's another one. Mystery motivator is another one that is excellent to do, and it's not as management intensive like the good behavior game. There's still some management, and it's still classroom-based, and it's still very peer-based. So the other one, that there's actually some really new studies coming out, in that peers are the mentor in check-in and check-out that has been very effective. So it doesn't just have to be an adult that can be the mentor in check-in and check-out, that they have shown that they can do it with peers, and it's successful. So there's four right there that we can definitely look at, that there's a lot of evidence that it does work. However, they are vastly different from one another, how they're set up, how they're used, the peer attention that's used. So one size does not fit all when it comes to...
It's true. However, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it, if I were to recommend that your viewers look at just one of those, it would be the good behavior game. It has the most empirical evidence, or I would say most, has a lot of empirical evidence. It's well supported, and it's relatively easy to implement.
That's great.
And I would suggest tootling if you have a child who is socially rejected, or you see the difference. They want peer attention, but they're getting peer rejected, or they are peer aggressive. So you're wanting them to actually have good peer relationships, but they don't really know how to develop that. And they are a peer attention Tootling is a really good one, although I am a big fan of the good behavior game. So just vastly two different interventions.
Absolutely.
And we did have one viewer question I wanted to sneak in.
Okay.
Serena's wondering, she thinks it's probably a staffing problem, but what can you suggest that school psychs do when the adults who are responsible for collecting, documenting the data are not doing it, or maybe not doing it consistently? They're not following the plan as written.
It's a great question, and it actually brings me to one of my favorite topics, and that's non-adherence in treatment planning and treatment adherence. And honestly, you're not going to like my answer. The answer is, what's the function of their non-adherence?
I thought of that when I asked the question.
Is it because what you're asking them to do is too difficult, so they're escaping from it? Mm-hmm. Is it because they're getting something from it? Maybe they're escaping from it in order to get someone to do it for them. It depends totally on the school, the structure, and the staffing. I hate to say it, but she was absolutely correct in her question. It is a staffing issue, but one in which you can use some of these same methods to help address.
That's great.
I would actually agree with that. That's actually one of the questions that we, and I'm going to kind of piggyback on that for a second, because one of the questions that was written in was about treatment adherence, getting staff buy-in, some of those things. And so Ryan and I actually had quite the discussion offline about that. And he is absolutely correct that we do need to look at the function of the educator's behavior. But there's also some other things that I think that we need to think about in that assessment. And one of the things is that we have a lot of literature, and we know about the barriers to implementation. Mm-hmm. And those barriers are well documented. Mm-hmm. About, you know, whether there's a social system for it, whether the organization supports it, whether, you know, the treatment is a negative treatment versus a positive treatment, whether there's some personal attributes for the student or the teacher. And then professional support for that. We often will give something, and then we don't, because we're so busy, we may not necessarily follow through or give them the kind of the coaching support to handle those things. And so when we're doing an assessment, we really need to listen to their verbal behavior. And there's really some emerging literature that I'm not going to get into tonight about consultation and verbal behavior, and thinking about what our teachers telling us when they're talking about the problem behavior, and really listening to that. That's what we're good at as school psychologists, is listening to the person as they're describing the behavior, or they're describing the problem, or they're describing what they're having difficulty with. And when we're listening to that, we really need to think about what the barriers are and what the possible functions are, so that we can immediately think about what kind of verbal statements can we say or do to get that script to flip a little bit, or that we can anticipate where we're going to have some issues. The concluding comment that I would make about treatment adherence or teacher buy-in is that, you know, I had a professor once tell me, you know, when you think about implementing, you think about, can I get some behavioral momentum? So if I ask a teacher to do something, can I ask them to do something smaller so they feel like they have some success? And then we're going to go on to the next piece. Instead of, we're going to tackle the biggest, largest, hardest piece first, because it feels overwhelming to them and the response effort is pretty high. So sometimes I'll do what we call behavioral momentum. We'll take the small one first. We'll get some momentum and some success with that, and then we'll move on to the next one. I will think about, and I will often ask a teacher the second question. If one thing could be greatly minimized or greatly maximized, whichever you want to, how you ever want to question that, what would it be? And then I work on that is the most important, because then I can get buy-in. It may not be behavioral momentum, but it may be the one that the teacher's having the most problematic. You know, this is causing the most stress. I realized in my first year of teaching that teachers actually really don't like students tapping their pencil. And that seemed to be, for one of my teachers, the most distressing behavior. So we tackled that one first. And then finally, Ryan Keystone behaviors. So if I can get you to do one thing, and I have a domino effect, okay? So if I get this thing to work and it starts to tip, and this one starts to act, you know, this behavior starts to change a little bit, and this one starts to change a little bit, I call it a keystone behavior so that I can get a domino effect. So those are the three kinds of questions that I really think about when I'm in the FBA process, along with kind of the barriers to implementation that I think are so important. So sometimes we are doing FBAs outside of the FBAs that we're requested to do.
Awesome.
Cool. I have a question, and then I know we've got a couple like viewer things to kind of wrap up that people have kind of follow up questions, but I'm going to interject because I can. So I'm thinking about, you know, those of us who I work with kids in kind of general education, and then I also work with, you know, classrooms or programs or separate schools or settings, you know, aimed towards children with emotional disabilities who have, you know, substantial emotionality type of things going on,
right,
and medication issues and things like that. And sometimes I feel like despite my best behavioral efforts, you know, I'm just not getting anywhere because they seem so unpredictable in just the level of their needs and how emotional and just kind of wild they are at times. With that type of thing, is that something that, I mean, there's so much research behind behavioral techniques and whatnot, so I'm guessing just keep at it with the behavioral isms, you know, or should I be approaching it more from a therapeutic type of standpoint? Does that make sense?
Great question. I guess I won't speak for Kristen here. Normally we don't mind speaking for each other, but this time I'm not going to. I come from the perspective where I say an emotion is another type of behavior. Mm-hmm. So where is that emotion coming from? What antecedents are triggering that behavior or that emotion? What are the consequences of that behavior or that emotion? We talked about anxiety a lot earlier. Anxiety belongs to, I'm going to try not to get too technical, but it's a response class, or it's a type of behavior that results in experiential avoidance. The idea that you're actually, anxiety results in avoidance of certain experiences. So when we talk about those emotions, we can simply put them back into behavioral terms and say, okay, I need to come at this from a different angle. What do I know? What evidence-based approach do I know that might still work here? And if that means coming at it from a cognitive behavioral perspective and taking sort of a rule-based approach to it, I have no problem with that. But it totally depends on the situation and the contingencies around that behavior, around that emotion. Hope that was actually an answer to your question.
I think that's helpful. We have one quick question that I think you can address quickly. Peer check-in, check-out, same age or older peer?
Well, one of the studies was, I do believe, older, but it's because they were little bitties. But if they're older, they can be the same age. So your little bitties need older, but if your kids are older, then they can have same-aged peers.
I would say it probably also depends on the kid. So maybe some clinical judgment is really relevant there.
No. Yep. Yes. Absolutely. And you know, to just ping off of Ryan just a little bit in your question, I would really encourage. I think that there's a third wave of behaviorism that's happening with Stephen Hayes's work in relational frame theory and acceptance and commitment therapy and some other shoot-offs to that, that we behaviorists believe that there are thoughts and there are emotions and all of those things. But we really do. And Stephen Hayes's work has really taken it to a whole nother level that brings, I think, the two communities together in a way that we can talk about it and come together instead of feeling like we're so far apart. Because I don't think that we've never felt that far apart. It's just that it's been sometimes difficult because the research hasn't been there. We're still a budding science to get there. But Stephen Hayes's work, I would really encourage you, because they've actually had some better results with anxiety than CBT or behavior therapy alone. Hmm. So it's very promising.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you, guys. We've run over in time, great, so we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, and you're just a dynamic duo. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, have a good night, everybody. I put some links on School Psych's podcast page, some of the things that were mentioned tonight. So please check them out and continue to share your thoughts and questions and ideas out there, because we can continue the conversation on social media. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks. Night, everybody.
Bye. Good night.